she is an entrepreneur, a Hall of Famer, a brand consultant, and a six-time author. But of course, there was a time when she wore none of these hats. We'll learn more about today's guest and how she was able to achieve so much in just a moment. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. And now I would like to welcome today's guest, Candy Conda. Candy, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, Candy, you heard me describe you with all these hats, an entrepreneur, a Hall of Famer, a brand consultant, an author, very much involved in sports, honored by the women's blue chip basketball team. You are doing a lot, but I'd like to start first with Candy as a little one. Tell us about where you were born and what your life was like as a little one.
So, wow, that was so long ago. I was born and raised in Chicago, Illinois, and to a mom who was a computer programmer. And so my childhood memories that I remember, which came so vividly when I saw the movie with Taraji, what was the movie? God, it was right here. I was just talking about it the other day.
That's what I just thought about when you said that. So, and I'm blanking on the...
Go ahead.
No, please continue.
No, I was talking about the movie with Taraji and the computer movie.
Yes.
I can't believe I'm drawing the blanking. I just spoke of it. But anyway, my mom, when we were young, we had to key punch every day before I went out to play. So when I saw the movie with, God, I can't believe I'm having a brain cramp. It's going to come to me in a second. When I saw that movie, I had like these instant flashbacks of time when, I had to work before I could go out and play. Yet a lot of my friends could just go out and play because my mom was into computers and, like I said, we had to work. And so I've always worked, even as a young kid. I worked all through high school. I worked at McDonald's and, I grew up in Chicago with, with my mom being a single parent. And like I said, working through high school. And so I've always been a person that, I guess always was, a leader and always worked really, really hard.
Now, when you were a little one doing key punching, what were you working on?
So, I can't believe we are not thinking about this movie. And it's driving me crazy. Now I'm trying to pull it up my iPad so I don't have to keep. So, my mom was a computer programmer, but she had a part-time business. And so, we were working on stuff for her clients. So, we had to, back... When you think about when you look at the Hidden Figures,
right.
That was going to drive me crazy. So when you look at the movie Hidden, So when you look at the movie Hidden Figures, and you see when they evolved to the where Octavia Spencer was in that big IBM room, that's what my mom used to do. She used to program those big computers. So she was ahead of her time. She had a small business in our basement. When you saw those key punch cards, they used to be all over our house. My mom used to leave me notes. She would leave us notes on the key punch cards, what they were called, the error cards. So you would go and you would have these key punch machines, and you would, they had a typewriter, and put the cards in there, and then you typed what was on the list. At that time, it could be a list of names or a list of account numbers for banks, and this is what she did at night. And so then you would take those key punch cards and take them back and feed them in the computer to get a printout. Of course, we know now we just type right in our typewriter on our screen and it prints out a printer, but it used to be a three-step process, actually. So you would type the cards would go to the printer, then they would print them out. And then, of course, if there was an error, so we had to go and check all of them, then we'd have to go back and correct it and then do another printout. And my mom always had to go to this big IBM center to, you know, put her cards in there, you know. And then, of course, she had computers and all this stuff, you know, as it evolved. So, like I said, I didn't play a lot. So it's always working.
And as a little one, what did you think about that? Were you annoyed with your mom? Did you appreciate what she was trying to do?
You know, I was annoyed, I think. I felt like I didn't have a childhood. I did take up dancing and a couple of other things, but it was really about helping my mom to, you know, save the world and helping, you know, her with my brother. And I really felt like I, you know, and it's so funny because I used to visit my dad and my grandmother on the weekend, and they used to be like, oh my God, you know, have some fun. Play, you know. So I mean, they would, you know, make sure that I went to, you know, the neighborhood YMCA and things of that nature. I did feel like I missed some of my childhood, and so I went into the military right after high school.
Now that's interesting. When you would go visit your dad and your grandmom, and they would tell you to play, did you know how to play?
I didn't. It took a long time for me to actually feel like it was okay to, you know, like my grandmother in the summers would enroll me in summer camp and things of that nature. And I really felt like, oh my God, so this is what this is like. But I always also felt like I was letting my mom down because I knew how much she depended on me as well. So I don't know that I really knew how to play. I did learn how to swim in summer camp. So that was one good thing.
How old were you when you started doing the key punch work with your mom?
9 years old.
Wow.
I've been key punching since I was 9. Mm-hmm.
So here you are, you're a little girl. You're actually an old lady in a lot of ways. You're working every day while you're going to school. You almost had 2 jobs. And then
right.
When you get out of high school, you go into the military, which seems to me like another very structured form of work. Why that decision?
I think I looked at it as getting away.
Wow.
Getting away and starting my own life. So that's how I envisioned it at the time. And, of course, you know how the military, they give you all these, oh, my God, you're going to fly planes and you're going to go all over the country and you're going to, you know how the recruiting videos, gosh, you feel like you're getting ready to slay the universe. Those are awesome. That's how they get all of us in there.
And that's how they got you in
great
there.
Videos.
You talked about flying the plane. So tell us what form of what branch of the military you decided to participate in.
So although I didn't fly planes, I did go into the Air Force, and I was a dental hygienist. I started off as a dental tech, and then I moved into the dental training. Promotion. And then after that, like I said, I ended up being a dental hygienist for probably the latter parts. I was in for 12 and a half years, almost 13.
Wow.
So I want to say for like the last eight or nine, I was working in dental. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed it. But I got hurt and then I medically retired out.
Now, I know somebody's asking, as am I, you were a dental hygienist. How did you get hurt?
So I got hurt in the first career that I went into. I went into supply initially. I wanted to get out of Chicago. I was ready to leave home. I was all that. And I took the first available job, which was working in the supply squadron. And I hurt my back. I threw my back out.
Okay.
So I cross-trained into dental. So I didn't get hurt in like war or anything like that. I cross-trained into dental. And so, but I always had this like nagging back issue. And so there came a time when they gave me an option to medical retire out. And I did that at the 13-year mark.
How did you find that you were treated as an African-American woman in the military?
That is such an awesome question. And even before I tell you that, I do want to say this one thing. A lot of people, I want to go back to what I consider the war question, because a lot of people say, oh my God, you know, you weren't in peacetime. But what a lot of people don't realize, and, you know, and this goes back to, you know, PTSD and a lot of things that women deal with in the military that they don't like to talk about. There was a time as a dental tech that I actually had to go and identify dead bodies for 2 years. And it really messed my head up for a while because you think that because dental back then, now they use DNA and other methods. Back then is for a military person. The only official ID that could be given was through their teeth.
Interesting.
Because when everyone goes in the middle, in the military, the first thing they do is they have to go to the dental clinic. That's the first stop. Get checked out and you go in and you get x-rays. That was in your first couple of days of being in the military, you get your dental x-rays. So if something does happen to you, because that's something that's unique to you, no one has the same to fillings, the same to bridges, the same to partials, the same to whatever. So, that was always one of the first things that you had to do was to get your dental x-rays done and, your regular checkup and everything. So we had the, unfortunate task of any time there was a plane that went down or a pilot crashed or whatever, we had to be on site to go and collect teeth, bring the teeth back, and then we would, use those teeth to identify fallen soldiers. And there were some times when it was something that was so gory that, to this day, I can see it like it was yesterday. So I say that because people don't sometimes give not that they have to, but give credit to peacetime. Everything doesn't happen in war. Some things happen in peacetime.
And so, let's be clear that when you were going to collect teeth, they weren't sitting in a pretty little box all wrapped up.
Absolutely. You had to get them wherever they were.
Gotcha. In terms of the trauma of that, did you feel as though you had any mental health awareness or understanding that helped deal with that trauma?
At that time, absolutely not. It was your job. And that's the one thing that when you're in the military, it's the military first. Your name is, military, whatever. you're Sergeant Conda. That's what your job is. So at that particular time, nobody talked about mental health. Nobody talked about PTSD. Nobody talked about any of that at that particular time. These are all things that have happened recently. This is all new.
Let me interrupt you, Candy, because you're fading in and out a little bit. On the cell phone, do you find that you're speaking directly into the phone?
What happened is I put a do not disturb one, but there's one like a news thing that just a feed that just still came through, and that's what happened. That when I went out for that second,
okay,
it was an alert that I just couldn't. I put a do not disturb one for some reason; it didn't override it.
Okay, then what we'll do when it happens again is just identify it so folks know that it's not their listening device.
Right.
Okay. All right. I'm going to pick up again and ask you the same question about treatment. Okay?
Okay.
All right. Let's be clear that when you were going to collect teeth, they were not all cleaned up and in a pretty little wrapped box for you.
Absolutely not. They were in helmets and among all kinds of stuff. They were sometimes thrown in different places, and you had to get them, and you had to get as many as you could locate so that, there was not a wrong identification made to a family member.
I can't really imagine what that would be like, particularly for, a young woman, or for anybody actually. It could be an old man in that environment where you're around dead bodies collecting their teeth to make sure that they are identifiable.
Right.
How much help? How much awareness did you experience as you were going through those traumas? Any mental health awareness or treatment or assistance or groups or anything like that to help you and your colleagues as you were experiencing these things?
You know, I was young, in my 20s at that time, and you didn't really think about that. You thought this was an elite position to be in, especially working in the dental clinic, because most of the time in a dental clinic, we did what you see happen when you go to the dental clinic. You go in, there's an assistant there, or you go in, they clean your teeth, and you go. So this was more or less an elite position that they put together, and only certain people were selected to do it. And so at that particular time, no, I mean, and you never heard of the PTSD and mental health and all that. You know, at that particular time, mental health was reserved for people that were all the way off the rails.
Okay.
It was not reserved for the average person that was going, you know, this, like I said, this all graduated in the last 15 years, I think maybe 15 to 20, to where PTSD was, you know, talked about amongst people. And that's another thing. In the military back then, you didn't mention mental health, and nobody talked like that. PTSD is really a new term. You know, it just started filtering down to be a common household name. And like the 10, I know people that would never have even admitted to that. That probably would have been grounds for them to either be thrown out or, like I said, are locked up somewhere.
So the idea, the experience of having an experience, a traumatic experience, and having the option to actually talk about it just didn't exist at that time.
Absolutely not.
How would you manage with what I have to assume were the range of responses that a trauma victim would experience? I mean, you experience these traumas, you try to find a way to get through these traumas so that you can continue to do your job. How did you manage that for yourself?
Talking to friends, sharing.
Okay.
And I was telling a doctor that I didn't eat red meat for years after that. I couldn't even stand the sight of red meat for many, many years. And then when I did start back eating it, you have thoughts, you have dreams, you have all kinds of things. And like I said, when I see red meat to this day, it's a trigger for me.
You know, that is such a profound experience and observation. And I do appreciate your sharing that with us, because so many times people really don't recognize what's the impact and the range of experiences that impact our folks in the military during peacetime as well as wartime. And of course, in wartime, it is just so much more often.
Right. And it's easier to identify.
Right.
Oh my God, I was in war and I saw someone die and, you know, or my friend got shot or killed, or I had to carry them to the front line. And it's so easy to identify.
Candy, I know that you and I are talking on the phone and that you were in Chicago. Every now and then, your voice, we lose a little bit of your voice, and I know it's because there are news alerts that are coming through on your phone. So I just want the listeners to be aware of that.
Yes, and I'm so sorry. I tried to, like I said, I tried to stop everything and do not disturb, but for some reason it doesn't, it goes more for the calls and things of that nature. It doesn't catch my regular news alert.
Well, the good thing
is... And I'd like to answer... Go ahead.
The good thing is that we know what the sounds are about. Candy, we're going to take
a
break. And when we come back, we will pick up right here. I know there's something that you want to add. So we will do that on the other side of the break.
Okay.
Sandy Conda, let's continue the conversation we were just having. You were talking about your experiences in the military. Was there more that you wanted to add about that?
Well, I wanted to answer your question.
Fair
you
enough.
Asked a question about women in the military.
Yes.
And because the Me Too movement is just so Me Too times up right now, and I notice it is filtering down to military, I did want to answer that. When I first went in the military, I went in wide-eyed, full of hope and promise, and, you know, and I never thought, I mean, my father used to always say, women, you know, the military is no place for women. And so for the most part, I did have like a couple supervisors that I thought, you know, wasn't really a sexual harassment thing, but that it was harassment against, that they were hard on women at that time. However, I also had some great women that were protectors, you know, some military lieutenants and captains and places of that kind of watched out for us as well. But yes, it did exist. We can't ignore that. And but I made it through.
You know, it's good to hear, because as these movements become more known to all of us, and it starts us to thinking about things in a very different way, I can't tell you the number of people I've talked to who have felt themselves traumatized by the current conversations simply is probably not the right word, because they are reminded of what they actually did experience, or what loved ones actually did experience. So it really is important to say, yes, that absolutely happened, and it happened to many people, but it didn't happen to you.
Right. Exactly.
As you came out of the military, we've talked a little bit about the trauma that you experienced. Were there other ways in which that military experience affected you, do you think, particularly as a woman?
So what the military did for me, and I think that every young person should go in the military. I don't care if it's for 2 years, and I'm going to tell you why. I went in looking for something else, to get away from home, to, like I said, to make some big changes in my life, to see the world, to get my education. That's why I went in, but I came out with so much more. I was able to travel the majority of my 13 years in overseas, in Spain and Germany and Europe. I was only in the States for about 5 years. So out of my 13 years, the majority of it was overseas. So I was able to travel through Europe and explore at a young age, other countries, other cultures, and it made me a leader, and it gave me some, you know, extreme discipline. And so to this day, no matter if I have a clock or not, I'm up at the same time every day. I am the clock. I'm up at 5 a.m. It doesn't matter if there's, I haven't had an alarm clock. I don't think I've ever owned an alarm clock. And I'm up and I'm working and I'm doing everything I need to do to get my day started. And although I was Air Force, we still the Army slogan that says, you know, I tell people daily, I do more by 9 than you've done all day, because I'm up and working at 5 a.m. every single day. So it gave me discipline to run my business, to be an entrepreneur. It taught me writing skills, because, you know, my mom had, you know, had us writing, had me writing, you know, key punching and reading reports and things of that nature. So I became a writer. I used to help all of my military friends when they got in trouble and they had to write these letters to explain to their commanders why they did something or whatever. They would always come to me. I would always write everyone's letters. So I've been writing for many, many years, which led to me, of course, being an author, being in the ghostwriter. Right now I'm writing, and I know we haven't got there. I'm writing 5 projects right now. So it did a lot for me. I say I went in for one thing and got so much more.
You know, so many people, as they experience new things or even the prospect of new things, find themselves fearful, which in and of itself is fine and certainly very human, but they allow themselves to be stopped by their fears. I'm wondering how you approaching new things.
I think fear is human.
Right.
Being scared is human. If you're not scared of something, then something is wrong. Because if you are human, there's going to be something on this earth that shakes you. But every single time I'm fearful, I use that as motivation. I check myself at the door and say, I mean, I'm getting ready to move across country in a couple months. And I told everybody I'm moving whether I sell my house or not. And of course, everyone looks at me with this wide-eyed, what are you doing, Willis? It's time. I need something new. It's funny because I was stationed at Nellis Air Force Base at one time. I'm moving to Vegas. Why? Because they have a lot of sports teams. It's a lot of opportunities there. My daughter lives in LA. It's closer on the West Coast, but it's something that I want to do. Am I scared? Yes, to my toenails, but it's something that I know that God and I, we've had talks, and this is what he wants me to do, where I need to be right now for this particular journey in my life. And like I said, sometimes you have to do what it is that you want to do, because guess what? This time waits for no one. Life is short, and we have more time, more time in back of us than we do ahead of us. And I tell anybody, you know what? I don't want you to look up and be regretful that you haven't. I just been on a month long trip every 3 weeks. I'm gone for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks. I love traveling. I'm traveling for business, and I wrap it all in together. And I just enjoy life, because I say that, you know, if you don't do it now, then when?
So it sounds like the way that you approach your fear of new things is to say, okay, I'm human. Yes, this unnerves me, but I'm going to do it anyway. And you look for ways to make it happen. Some people look for proof that it won't happen. That's not you.
No, it's not. And I don't even know anything about that.
Good. Keep not knowing. What did you do when you got out of the military? I mean, you'd been in there for certainly a long time. And to start something young and then come out and be less young, I wonder, how was the world different, if it was different, when you came out of the military?
Well, first of all, I had a baby.
Well,
so
there's
I came
that.
Out with a brand new baby.
Okay.
There's that. I came out with a brand new baby. And decided to be opted out of this wedding that I was supposed to have, and decided to be a single mom.
Talk
about
that.
I decided it wasn't going to work. Which part?
Talk about opting out of the wedding. You come out of the military. You're pregnant. Sounds like there was a little fraternization going on somewhere. And there was a wedding that you were supposed to have, but you said, nope, never mind. Talk about that decision to be a single mom.
Well, of course, I don't think anyone, well, today, I don't know, maybe some of these younger women, but I mean, most people, especially back then, nobody just wanted to be a single mom. Like, oh my God, I'm getting ready. I mean, but there are some people that do say, hey, I want to have a baby no matter what. That wasn't really the case. It was someone that was in the Army. And we were both stationed in Germany, and we, you know, it just wasn't working out for me. And although, you know, we were chopping for the rings and all of that, I was like, you know what, I don't really want to do it. It didn't feel right. We were on opposite ends of the, he wanted to stay in Germany. I wanted to go back to the States. And after that, things just started to unravel. And I just, like I said, I wasn't feeling it. And I was like, you know what, I'm just going to stay a single mom for now. If it's meant to happen, it will. And of course it didn't. And so but the one thing I'm glad, though, you know, he was in my daughter's, him and his, you know, his family was in my daughter's life. I mean, they're like thick as thieves. So that's the one thing I was not going to do. And I would tell, you know, moms all over the world, try to let your child have a relationship no matter what. But it wasn't for me. I wanted to rule the world, and I wasn't ready to just be saddled down and just become, you know, mom, wife, work. When I got out of the military, I had already decided I was starting a business. I went to work for a company for about 4 years, and I started my business while I was working there, and I've kind of never looked back. You know, I worked for the state of Illinois for 15 years, but I've always been an entrepreneur, and I'm a full-time entrepreneur now, and I love it, and I love what I do, and, you know, kind of business is my husband. I've been married. I haven't really, though. I don't want to act as if I just jump right into, you know. So I did the marriage thing, and, you know, but I love business. That's my thing.
All right. Business is my husband. That sounds like another book.
You're gonna have me laughing the whole time. It might be. It might be. Business is my husband. Yeah, I like that.
You like that? I'm gonna let you have that.
Mm-hmm.
I only need 10%, and we'll be good.
Yes. All right.
What was the first business that you chose to create?
So the first business that I chose to create was, at one point I was selling apparel. Earrings and things of that nature, because I was working a day job. So I started selling t-shirts and earrings at my job. And then I tried, and then I had a boutique, and then I sold, and then I had an insurance company in the same building. So I had an insurance company down the hall from a boutique. And for years I did those two things. I realized I hated insurance. And then the boutique, it just got old. You know, people started selling. They weren't selling online yet at that point, but it just started evolving this into something different. I was carrying clothes out. You know, I was doing really good, but I also had to bring clothes out because our boutique wasn't on a storefront. It was upstairs.
Okay.
So, 'cause we had the insurance company first. So, you know, those kind of things, you know, made me, you know, change my mind about some things that I wanted to do. And I started back writing books, doing public speaking, and then I went back to work for the state of Illinois. And while I was working for the state, I was the director of education for and conferences for the Illinois Institute for Entrepreneurship Education. So we helped other entrepreneurs get their businesses off the ground. So as I was doing that, that's kind of what really my whole life that started and my life into what it is now, helping others. So initially I helped other people in consulting with them getting their business started. I used to do business plans, that sort of thing. And then I've always had this knack for marketing, and which evolved into branding. And so for the last 15 years, I've really been helping people to brand their business, make their vision come true. But I do things that most people don't do. I am the person that will look and say, well, what is it that you really, really want to do? I want to write a book. Okay, fine. Well, let's make that happen. How, you know, and then they'll say, then I have a client that says, but I can't write. So I says, well, I'll write the book for you. So let's get it done. So I'm one of those people that don't take no for an answer. And I never say what can't happen. It's that there's a way for everything to happen.
Talk about
branding.
Talk more about branding, because it's a word now that, you know, is on everybody's lips. Everybody wants to brand something or other. But what does that actually mean?
Isn't that funny? It's so funny. Everybody's an author. Everybody's a speaker. Everybody's a radio personality. So, you know, I'm a multi-hyphenate. So I put something in my title that everybody's not. So I lead off with Hall of Famer.
There you go.
That's my inside joke. But anyway, you know, branding is making sure that everyone can find you. That's what I always say. If you are branded, everyone can find you without a business card. So that means that you have to be, everything must be consistent. So I have a football player client that I picked up over the weekend. And so I said to him, how can I find you if you don't give me a business card? And he says, well, you know, and he gave me the whole, you know, well, I have to give you this and that. No, you need to be able to find searchable on social media. So let's do that. So we started out because, of course, they want me to make them famous overnight. No, we're going to start with the basics. We need a business. We need a social media sites, and we need a website. And don't name them all differently. So I am Casey BizBoss. If you type that in, you're going to find me somewhere. My digital footprint is out there because my website is Casey BizBoss. My email is CaseyBizBoss@gmail. My social media sites, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat are all Casey BizBoss. So branding is really leaving a digital footprint that you can be found without a business card. And that means all of that. And then after you've got the basic social media website, that digital footprint in place, and then the next one is actually making sure that if you write a book, that it's on the back of your book, that you're constantly leaving these social media, these digital footprints that all lead to one place in the universe. So that's really what it is. So when I go out wearing my apparel, so when I go out and do interviews, I may have a Nike shirt on, but I normally cover it up with a Hall of Fame Casey BizBoss badge. You know, I've got my hats that say Casey BizBoss on them. So it's everything. It's apparel. It's the digital footprint. It's the when you go out and tell people, hey, follow me at Casey Bisbaugh, saying it out of your mouth. It's all of these things coming together that really make the brand. And of course, going to the next level, the radio show, and then using the same name. If you're on a television interview, using it there. If you have any platform that you use, using that same brand so that digitally it starts getting wings. And that's really what it is. But a lot of people use, when they say branding, you know, they tell people, oh, you know, make sure you know, it's just a website and your social media. It's really much more than that, but it does start there.
So I just want to repeat what you just said, because you dropped that a little bit. You're saying that branding, yes, a website is important. Yes, social media is important, but it's much more than that.
Absolutely. Like I said, for me, I have apparel that has my logo on it. And let me tell you, all of that makes a difference, because now people will say, you know what? I remember you because you had a shirt with your name on it.
Interesting.
It said Hall of Famer on it. Or I remember that I saw you on this show. I always remember that, you know, you have your hat with Hall of Famer on it. So it's much more than to me. In terms of, if you really want to brand yourself, you have to really make people know who you are. They've got to remember you when you walk out of the room. And a business card, they may lose it. So you need something that's different and unique that sets you apart from everyone else. And that, to me, is the essence of branding.
Are business cards important? Are they relevant today?
They're relevant in some settings, because there are some people that you may not have any other way to contact them, because you may not be a social media person.
Okay.
So you may, I mean, a lot of times, like when you go out to these young events, like I went out with my daughter this weekend, everybody says, what's your Instagram? They want to follow you on Instagram. However, when you, that's their business card. But if you go to a traditional business meeting, there may be no other way to get someone's information. So I say get a business card, but I normally keep my business card viral, or I'll keep it on my cell phone and I'll say, let me text it to you. That does two things. That gives me your phone number. And then, of course, I don't have to carry a lot of business cards around.
Interesting. Well, I'm learning as I'm talking to you. You have referenced the term Hall of Fame a few times in the last few minutes. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, I want you to tell us about this Hall of Fame business. Deal?
Deal.
Okay. Folks, stay where you are. We will return in just a moment with Casey Bisbaugh. Don't go away. Welcome back to this edition of Mind Talk. We're continuing the conversation with Candy, who from now on we are going to call Casey Bisbaugh. Casey Bisbaugh, how about you spell that for us?
K-C, like Kansas City, B-I-Z-B-O-S-S. That's one Z and two S's.
There you go. I love it. Tell us about Hall of Fame. What is this Hall of Fame business?
So, back in 1992, I had my own sports mega paper, and it was just a small newsletter, and I used to cover, it was my, almost like a little hobby at that time. I had played soccer for the Air Force, and I'd always been a sports person, and so I was interested in sports. I would always go out and cover kind of like unsung heroes, Thurl Ladding's rodeo and women in basketball players. One of the basketball teams says, hey, we don't have a PR person. And at that time, PR wasn't what it is today. That was just, you know, at that point, it was still marketing. They're like, you're really good at this, because, of course, I would market my sports newsletter. And so it was called Superfans. And so they asked me to, you know, so I did a little article on them. And then they said, well, you know, why don't you represent us and, you know, do some, like I said, marketing, PR. And I did that. And they found there was going to be, and they were just an exhibition team called the Chicago honeybees. And so this was actually, I think, in like 91, 92 at this point. And so they said, guess what? It's going to be a new league coming and we want to be in that league. So can you help us? So yes, I came out to their games and, you know, did all kinds of little highlight things into the newspaper. And then I helped them to get some just notoriety, visibility, I'll say that, and exposure. And then they put in a request to be part of this league. So when the league decided they were going to come to Chicago, there was some NBA and NFL players that said they wanted to buy the spot for the Chicago team. I'm like, this is awesome. So I married everybody together, my little, you know, checkmate game that I like to play. I'm like excited. And then these players dropped out.
Oh, no.
And said they were the financiers of this and said they didn't want to do the Chicago team. So my heart was sinking. And then the team decided they didn't want to do it. And so the league, though, that was the WBA, decided they still wanted to put a Chicago team here. They says, look, we've got a team called the Indiana Stars and a team called the Iowa Twisters, and we're getting ready to get rid of the Iowa Twisters. And we want to make the Indiana team the Chicago team, but we still need someone to buy this team. I was like, yes, we do. So they were like, well, you've done everything. You've done all the legwork. Why don't you buy the team? I was like, I don't have that kind of money. At that time, franchises were like $50,000, right? Which is funny every time I say that. So they said, well, tell you what, come up with $10,000 and we'll sell you the team. At least come up with $10,000 down payment. I said, okay. So excuse me, I got with all my brain trust and everybody was like, yeah, I'll give you $1,000. They didn't have GoFundMe back then. I laugh every time I say this. They didn't have GoFundMe. So GoFundMe was ask this person, that person, you know, make a list of your top closest friends and top 50 or 100 closest, you know, friends and family and see if you can get $10 from everyone. So believe it or not, I came up with the $10,000 and put the down payment. I remember that day. I mean, I faxed the letter through and we wired the money. And it's so funny listening to all this now. Think of PayPal and all the cash apps and everything we use now. But
right.
Yeah. So we, you know, we faxed that document. We wired the money. And then we went to Michael Jordan's restaurant. Myself, Harvey Catchings, Willie White, who's a famous Olympian, and Jim Rose from Channel 7 was there covering it. And it's so funny because I talked to Harvey the other day. He's Tamika Catchings' dad. A lot of people don't know Harvey, but everybody knows Tamika. You know, she worked for the president, Olympian, WNBA player. And so, so we all, you know, we did our announcement. The players there, the two players from the we had a grandfather in three players, I think it was, from the Indiana team. Everyone else we did tryouts for. And so before then, actually the Naismith Hall of Fame, so as soon as that happened, the Naismith Hall of Fame had already gave me an award for being the first African-American woman I got some kind of award from the Naismith Hall of Fame as well. But anyway, so fast forward.
Let me help you out with that. You were given an award for being the first African-American woman to manage a pro basketball team.
Right. So that happened. Yeah, but I was trying to get my timeline together. And thank you for that. That happened after, though, I bought the team. So I own the team and I manage the team, which was, so I had two designations technically. And so, and at the time, you know, they were trying to not give us the pro term at first because a league came behind us, the ABL, and they started playing during the winter months the same time the guys were. So they were trying to call us initially a semi-pro team because we played in the summer and called them a pro team. And then what happened is they folded and didn't make their first year. And then when the WNBA started, they picked up the same schedule we had. And since they were, you know, considered professional teams, we got our designation as a professional league as well. And so then after that, we won the championship. My head coach was Stephanie Rivera, who is Ron Rivera's wife, the coach of the Carolina Panthers.
Okay.
And then after that, we were bought out for a year so that the games could be televised by Liberty Sports Network. And then they reverted back our ownership and then folded us in the last year in 1994. And so after that, we were supposed to be purchased by the WNBA, but we did not. That did not happen. And so everyone went on to their lives. And then after that, I was first, like you said, awarded acknowledged by the Naismith Hall of Fame. And then they put a women's wing, because this is pre the WNBA, Women's Basketball Hall of Fame. They didn't have that at that point.
Okay.
They didn't erect until 1996 or something. So 1998, whatever, after the WNBA. So at that time, we had a wing in the Naismith Hall of Fame. And, of course, they brought me to the Naismith Hall of Fame and awarded me there. And then that was my first award. And then I didn't do anything for a very long time basketball-related, to be honest with you. I was kind of hurt. It was just a lot of pain that went into that whole purchase and the way it disbanded and the WNBA part of it and all of that. So I kind of left it alone for a very long time. And then I don't know what happened, but one day, one of my friends says, she ran across an old article and she says, you know, they really owe you a lot. You know, they don't know that if it wasn't for you, Chicago would have never had the team that they have now, or, the Chicago Sky and all this. They don't know. They really owe you a debt of gratitude. I'm like, hey, this isn't the Negro League. They don't care about that these days. And they really don't. I'm sad to say. Yeah, so they don't care. So she's like, we're going to make them care. I'm like, okay, this is great and everything. I love this rah-rah moment. But, you know, but after she, you know, after our conversation, what I did do is I started collecting stuff a little bit at a time. I started collecting, you know, and then once the Women's Basketball Hall of Fame erected, they took everything from the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame, because they're like, hey, y'all got your own ball off the Hall of Fame now. We don't have to carry all your stuff. We're going to disband this wing. So they sent some stuff to me, and the rest of it they sent on to the Women's Basketball Hall of Fame. So they would have artifacts and team jerseys and things of that nature from all the other women's basketball teams. And mind you, I need to mention, in Chicago, there hadn't been a women's basketball team since 1977, the Chicago Hustle. So we were the first in the 90s. And so after that, fast forward, I started collecting everything, and the Women's Basketball Hall. So the Women's Basketball Hall of Fame, they sent me the applications and everything to be included. I sent them all of that, and they said, well, you're on our waiting list. You know, we'll call you. Don't call us. it might be 5 years. It might be 15 years. It might be 25 years. I'm like, so you're saying I could be dead, right? When you guys actually, you know. So, but they did the vetting process, and they sent me my information. So we did all the research. You are the first African-American woman, blah, blah, blah.
Wow.
So they said, but what we have done for you is we sent this out to other Hall of Fames. So they sent it out to the African-American Hall of Fame. And they basically says, hey, we want to induct you like in the end of the month kind of thing, where I was like, well, okay then. So they inducted me in the African-American Hall of Fame, vetted by the Women's Basketball Hall of Fame. And here we are. And so then, also to fast forward, after I wrote my book called It's Your Go Season, I wrote that a couple years ago. I was inducted in 2014, by the way, in the African American Hall of Fame. So, and I always said, you know what? I was African American first before I was a woman. So there, So take that. But I did want to also say the league that we, the WBA, the founder of the league, just wrote his book a year ago. Called The Vision, which chronicles his vision to have a women's basketball league, and you know how he did it. And he said the WNBA kind of stole his story, stole his platform, and stole his idea. I don't have anything to do with that, but that's what's in the book. And but they've done a documentary, and it has won 5 cities, first place award. In 5 cities, and they're getting ready to show it again in one in Hollywood and some other places. And so I am a part of that documentary, and they're looking to make it a big screen, movie soon. So we'll see.
And you heard it. You heard it first here on Mind Talk. The accolades that you've had and the things that you've done, you know, working with sports figures, writing books, being an entrepreneur, for the folks who are listening who are saying, well, that's her and that's not me and I can't do that and blah, blah, blah. What do you say to them?
I say that everyone has a genius gift of their own. and they have to tap into it. And if you've ever just sat at night and thought, wow, this is what I would like to do, or I have this gift and I haven't tapped into it, I say tap into it. I say wake up and shake out of it. Because you don't know if you don't try what you can really achieve. And that goes for every person. That is, everyone has a special gift or talent that is unique to them. It might be doing makeup. It might be doing hair. It may be maybe writing. It may be working, making jewelry. I have one of my assistants, and also she coordinates some of the things we do for our sports platform. She's a jewelry maker, jewelry designer. I have on her pieces all the time. She gets orders all the time. Not to mention now, she has been in like 10 movies, her jewelry. So you never know how things connect. Everything kind of connects together. And a lot of times we want to go straight to the top. You know, everybody wants to be on top, but nobody wants to go first. Sometimes you got to go first.
Interesting. Absolutely. The contacts that you've made over time, do you find that you ever feel, this is a well-known person, this is a big deal person, I'm not really sure how to approach this? Or do you just go do it?
I go do it.
Okay.
I go do it because I'm just fearless that way. If I'm in a networking environment or I'm in an environment, I'm going to, you know, they can blow me off if they want, but I go do it. But here's something that I do. I also have experience. A lot of people go out and network. Like, I'll give you an example. I've just been at 5 different states in the last month. I've been to NFL Super Bowl week, NBA All-Star week, Vegas. Back in Chicago for a couple of days of those, and then on to other cities. And I'm in a lot of events, and I'm around a lot of celebrities. And I always have photos with everybody because, hey, I'm like, hey, you know, I have NBA, NFL players that says, hey, Hall of Famer. That's what that branding does for you.
Gotcha.
That's what the branding does for you. You need to create your own brand. Your brand can be just as big as anyone else. My brand is Hall of Famer. That's right. And it's so funny because when people see my patch, it's an official patch of my brand. But they think it came from the Hall of Fame. Hey, whatever.
Okay.
I am the Hall of Fame. I'm me. We're the Hall of Fame for one. So you have to create your brand. You have to be you and let your brand go in front of you.
The people that you work with, the celebrities that you work with, there are some people who will be so, what can I say, awed or challenged by the fact that they are actually in the space of a quote-unquote celebrity, that they forget that celebrities are people. What do you say to those folks?
Let me tell you, celebrities really are people. I was just talking to a celebrity friend of mine the other day, and he's like, you know, I'm trying to figure out the next chapter of my life. And I told him, I said, and this is someone I consider, you know, a friend, has been a client before. And I said, you know, I said, everybody is trying to figure out their what's next, because you can have something and you're excited, everybody is excited, and then you look up and it's not happening anymore. I was sitting with some NBA moms. We had dinner last year with them after one of the events that we had. And I was listening, when you talk about that celebrities are people too, I was listening to the moms say, people don't understand. Our kids have made sacrifices that people don't even know and have to smile through it while they're getting cut, while they're sitting on the bench, while their money is getting cut. There are going to be some people that says, oh yeah, that's the price you have to pay. But you know what? Look at what they are putting their bodies through.
Yes.
For the entertainment of other people. Yeah, that's the life they chose. But, I mean, if without that, you wouldn't have NBA basketball to watch every week, and your fantasy basketball and your NBA 2K. All of those people are not making the same money. There are a lot of them that are on the bottom. They're sitting on the bench.
literally
trying to get there, just
right.
like your kids are.
Right.
So, you know, everything is, you know, everything is a challenge. Every, you know, they are human. They bleed. I've talked to the NFL alumni in several different cities, and they were saying, like, a lot of these guys, they get hurt. Their health is bad. You know, they didn't get the big buyout package. And that's what my NFL friend was saying. You know, when my NBA friend, he was saying, when we were in, we knew we had to get a real job after this was over. He's like, these guys got these big, huge salaries. But that, so that's not everyone. And I, you know, if I could, the one message that I would love to give to every mom out here, and especially the millennial moms, is that you need to hold on to your kids a little bit closer, a little bit tighter. Know what they're doing. Watch their social media. You know, limit their use to, limit their watch, their viewership in these video games and these music videos and social media. There's a real problem out here right now with suicide. And that's because a lot of these kids actually, they have, if they're not going through the fear of missing out, which really should not be a real thing. FOMO should not be real, but it is. You know, it is. These kids, they don't feel adequate, you know, because they're looking at what's going on in the media, and media is getting paid a lot of money to make things more realistic than they really should be. And that's from reality shows up and down to the music that's out here right now.
So hold on to your children a lot tighter than you might have. Be more aware of what's going on with your children.
Exactly. In social media, computers, technology, the video games, and a lot, because there are a lot of subliminal messages. Limit their time even on their cell phone. You know, when they come home, put the cell phone up, you know, because a lot of they just have too much access. And access mind messes up adults. So if you think of kids who their you know, their mental cortex or their frontal cortex is not really adapt to handling all of this. That's my next book is really going to be on the social media effect.
Well, you know, we're out of time today, but when you get that next book done, I want you to come back and talk to us about that, because you're making a point now that I don't think many people hear, and it is an important one. So before we let you go today, I'm going to invite you back.
All right. Yes, I love it. I've had so much fun, even though now I've told my whole life story, and you warned me.
Before we absolutely have to get out of here, what is a website, a place where people can find Casey BizBoss?
CaseyBizBoss.com and LifeAfterSports.biz.
Great. Thank you again so much, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you so much. This was amazing.
All righty. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. It's available to you on demand through a number of resources. MindTalk.org, MindTalk.org is the primary source. You can download the MindTalk app from iTunes or Google Play. I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to MindTalk. So do send an email to me at Pamela@MindTalk.org. That's Pamela at MindTalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.